Tango Tango Papa 1804, December 5, 2013.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Albertville, Alabama. And so I spent the night last night at Nashville, Illinois. And so I woke up this morning, I don't know, I guess it was pushing 9:30 when I woke up. And it's kind of surprising. When I went to bed last night, of course, it was above freezing. And so when I woke up at 9:30, it was, I guess right there at Nashville, Illinois, it was 30 degrees, and it was actually drizzling a little bit. And so it was kind of weird. It was freezing, the drizzle, rain, whatever it was, because it kind of varied a little bit. Was freezing like on the truck mirror and on the hood and what have you. It was freezing there. The road and the ground was more than warm enough where it wasn't freezing on the ground or on the road, but what was really weird, it wasn't freezing on the trees either. Normally, if it's going to freeze on the mirrors, then it'll freeze on trees. So that was kind of strange. Continued for a ways until I got, I pretty much from Nashville, Illinois, you go east, I don't know, probably at least maybe 30 miles, and then you go south on Interstate 57, Mount Vernon, Illinois, and that's where I stopped and filled the truck up with fuel. There's truck stops and what have you there. So that's where I filled the truck up with fuel, and then continued on south, and then south on I guess it's 24. You sort of go southeast on Interstate 24 and go through, I guess, Marion, Illinois, somewhere in there, and then Paducah, Metropolis, Illinois, and then you cross the river into Kentucky, Paducah, Kentucky, and so on and so forth. And by the time I got down to Paducah, it was, or even Metropolis, it was probably, I guess it was in the 30s, like 38 degrees. And then as I continued on, it kept getting warmer. So when I stopped this evening, I stopped around 5 o'clock, actually a little bit before 5 o'clock, and it was dark before 5 o'clock at South, I don't know, it was, don't know the name of the town, but it was probably 40, maybe 40 miles south of Nashville, Tennessee. It was 48 degrees there and raining. And so, of course, now I'm at Albertville, Alabama, and when I stopped, it was 68 degrees. And it looks like it's raining a little bit now, and I think it's supposed to get to 48 degrees. The guy looked at his weather widget. Mine said it was supposed to be 57, but his said 48. So sometimes those weather widgets will sort of argue with each other depending on which weather forecasting service they're sort of grabbing the data from. So right now, I've got, it was about 68 degrees, and so I may have to turn on some air conditioning, because I've got the windows rolled up, and the only thing is just me in here, and I've got some lights turned on inside so I can see in here, and it's actually getting warm to the point where I'm starting to sweat a little bit. So I may have to actually kick the air conditioner on a little bit to kind of cool back down. Now I'm expecting sometime overnight. If it does cool down, I'll check again here in a bit. If it does cool down to 48, then that's cool enough. I need some heat. Now, if it's just, you know, if it's just going to cool down to about 57, then don't even really need to worry about heat. But if, you know, I think it's probably going to end up cooling down because, you know, it's kind of cold, all, you know, across a broad swath of the country. This cool air is moving in. At home, it was in the 20s today, Northwest Arkansas, and it looks like it's snowing there. I can kind of look and tell if there's snow out on the ground. The remote IP cameras that I have, got two of them pointed out the windows, so I can see, especially out of the one up in the front bedroom, this aimed out the window towards the road. The snow is kind of accumulating, and it's sort of done that mostly after dark. It was kind of doing it a little bit, you know, you're getting a little bit of white here and there around 5 p.m. It was starting to accumulate a little bit, not much, just, you know, just little patches of it here and there, but it looks like it's a lot more now that it, you know, that it's been going on for several hours at this point, and I don't know how much longer it's supposed to go on. I know parts of the state were supposed to really get heavy ice and potentially, so hopefully, I don't know, depending on what it does, if it stays cold enough, it's more likely to, you know, maybe come down as snow and not ice. Ice really kind of creates a problem if you get very much of it, because it obviously has a tendency to really mess things up as far as trees and electrical wires and things like that, antennas. So hopefully the majority of it will just come down as snow, but we'll just have to wait and see what happens. You know, as ever so often we'll get an ice storm every few years, and that's just part of living there. It does happen in a lot of areas from time to time, and that's just the way it is. The weather's the weather, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it other than go somewhere else, unless you prepare for it. So, in any case, I've got some more stuff about China, some more stuff I collected from YouTube. And this first piece that I want to play is more about the Chinese, this cultural, so-called cultural revolution. And what you have to realize, it's kind of a hard thing to describe. You know, there's this idea that people are people are people, and the only thing that's different is just their form of government. And it really goes well beyond that. It's not, you can have the most wonderful government in the world, or you can have the most rotten government in the world. But, you know, in this case, let's say that you got the most wonderful government in the world, and you got the most perfect set of rules. Well, if people have no ethics, then and you're relying on the sort of police state to enforce it, it's not going to work. You're going to have corruption. You're going to have mass corruption everywhere, and that's kind of what China has, even though they're kind of now they're sort of moving into, you know, a more modern country, sort of very rapidly modernizing. There's still lots of corruption and so on and so forth. Even though people's lives have ostensibly gotten better, there's still lots and lots of corruption and so on and so forth. And that's in this book that I've been listening to, which I finished listening to today, called Factory Girls, which, by the way, that's on Audible. You can probably, I'm sure you can buy a paper version or like a Kindle version or whatever, an electronic book version, but I've got the Audible version. it's about 15 hours and some change long, and well worth either listening to or reading. One of the women that the author interviewed said that basically, you know, in regards to corruption that's present in the society and how everyone has a tendency to lie, this one character said, well, no matter what you do, you can either try to not participate in it or so on and so forth, but you're not going to change it. You can do whatever you want to, but you're not going to change the culture. And that's pretty much true. The only thing that you can do, really, you know, you can try to not participate in it or try to not perpetuate it or you can just, you can have your morals yourself, and that's really what you have to do, because this idea that you do as I do or do as I say, not as I do, what good is that? You know, there's plenty of people that do that. Parents do that all the time with their kids. Do as I say, not as I do. Well, sorry. So what you have to, you know, the only thing that you can possibly do, and you're not going to save the world, you know, forget about that. The only thing you can possibly do, besides, you know, kind of changing the way you react to the world, and that's the biggest thing right there, is changing the way you react to the outside world and to people and pressure and so on and so forth, is find, you know, by that act, you know, changing the way that you react, because that, you know, it's in the very word, react. You're reacting. The only thing you can do, really, is to stop reacting and, you know, act from, you know, something original. Something original within you that, you know, and hardly anybody ever does that. It's not to be found. There was one guy that did it, and they crucified him. So you have a country like China, you know, where they're, you know, it's just groupthink, groupthink, groupthink. Groupthink, if you read this book, you listen to this book, it becomes very obvious, and the author kind of talks about it to a certain extent, you know, about how, or she, because she's wondering, well, what is it within the Chinese character that enabled something horrible like the Cultural Revolution to happen. And she talks about it somewhat. But what you have to understand is that, you know, this sort of groupthink mentality is created. And it's kind of like The Matrix. If you watch The Matrix movie, you know, you had the concept that the men in black type thing, you know, the government, you know, in fact, it was the computer, you know, the computers that were controlling everyone, could just kind of take over any place they wanted to. And so if you remember the scene where they're kind of going, you know, they break into the, you know, go break through, the, they go through this apartment where this woman is, elderly woman is cooking. And, you know, as they go through the apartment on this chase, they go through the apartment, the elderly woman turns into one of these government agent with the dark sunglasses and the earpiece type. You know, so, you know, the idea being that anyone, you know, that they can just kind of take over anyone at any point. And that is actually a very good metaphor for what happens with groupthink. something, if you know, if there's this sort of an externalized identity that people have, and you call it your culture or whatever, and you try to be proud of your culture, and it's insanity, it's hell, and you can't admit that your thoughts are not your own. But there's something evil. Evil is in charge of that. And so the most absurd things take over. And the worst becomes the loudest. And so there's this bully that is sort of a bullying groupthink that sort of happens. And it happens in every revolution, you know, that you can accept. The only one that didn't really happen in is the American Revolution. And that's a special case. But every other revolution, French Revolution, any other revolution you can name, there's this this groupthink mentality sort of takes over, and you end up with usually end up with either more of the same or a lot of times even something worse than what people were revolting over. You know, the king is dead, long live the king type of thing. And so this cultural revolution is just sort of more of an extreme example of what can happen. You know, it's the same thing happened with, Hitler Germany. People were suggestible, and so you come along and, like Russia under communism. Any opportunistic infection can just come along and take over, and the opportunistic infection can be, you know, somebody that thinks that they're making the world better. You know, I do believe Hitler thought he was making the world, he was going to make the world better. And certainly Mao Zedong thought he was going to make the world better. He's going to make a better China. You know, and Stalin really thought he was going to make a better, you know, Marx, you know, they thought they were going to make a better Russia, better society. They really believed that they could. And there are people that today believe that. And of course, it's a lie. They believe a lie. And it always ends up bringing hell on earth. And so in our fallen state as human beings, we are sort of in a halfway house between heaven and hell. So it's a... But anyway, I could go on and on, but so let me go ahead. I want to play this first one. This first one is about, it's going to be about 52 minutes, and it's about the Cultural Revolution. It's the audio for another documentary about the Chinese Cultural Revolution. So I'm going to go ahead and play that. So here that is.
In 1958, 9 years after coming to power, Mao wanted to bring China out of its almost medieval state of underdevelopment. He launched a program of industrialization in towns and in the country, intended to take China into the promised land of the socialist paradise in less than 15 years. It was the Great Leap Forward. By But the crazy dream became a nightmare and dragged 650 million Chinese people into hell. The country sank into economic chaos, which caused an unprecedented famine. The terrible death toll was around 45 million. Even today, Mao is an untouchable icon. As the founding father of Red China, he holds the nation together and gives legitimacy to the current authorities. So as not to damage his image, the Chinese Communist Party has maintained a deafening silence on this tragedy for 50 years. For the first time, this film is raising the curtain on this bloody episode in Chinese history. Getting the few witnesses to talk about the period and trying to reconstruct the memory of the Great Famine is not without danger. Very few have dared to defy the taboo and break the silence. Zhu Sun, a young historian from the University of Hong Kong, felt she had to take on this task. Over 4 years, she crisscrossed the Chinese countryside to collect the testimony of survivors of this terrible tragedy.
As soon as I think about that time, my legs start to shake and I feel a great sadness. I prefer not to think about it because I feel pain when people talk about it.
Among the people she talked to, many had never had a chance to tell their story, and some survivors are very elderly. So Zhu Chun's task was an urgent one. For her, it isn't only a duty of memory, it's also a personal story, since several members of her family died of starvation during the Great Leap Forward. Yang Zhisheng, a journalist and historian, published Tombstone in 2008. It was the first Chinese book on the Great Famine. Published in Hong Kong, it has been banned in mainland China. His own father died of starvation during that period.
Even if no one from my family had died of starvation, I would still have written the book, because it's very important. As a journalist, I had to bear witness. I did it so that future generations can know the truth.
To understand how the Great Leap Forward caused the death of tens of millions of people, we must go back to the origins of the communist regime, the taking of Beijing by the Red Army in January 1949.
The central government of the people is established.
For Mao, who wanted to make a clean break with the past, the task was huge. He had to overcome the traditions, the mindsets, the archaic ways of life of an old-fashioned society. He also had to stamp out the endemic famines and their processions of misery. The Chinese expected a lot from their new regime. They had heard the communists promise to build a fairer society. To realize his plans, Mao went to Moscow to ask Stalin for economic help and to consolidate the strategic alliance with the USSR. The Chinese leader felt huge admiration for his Soviet counterpart, who nevertheless treated him with contempt and made him wait 2 days before seeing him. The two countries signed a treaty of friendship. The USSR would supply China with huge quantities of arms, factories, industrial and farming equipment, and all kinds of advisors. This treaty sealed China's dependence, as the aid didn't come free. Not only did China commit itself to remaining within Moscow's circle of influence and following its economic model faithfully, but it would also have to repay the huge debt it had contracted. As the first step towards the Soviet model, less than a year after coming to power, the Chinese communists started a massive reform of agriculture. It affected half of all cultivated land and benefited 300 million poor peasants. All over China, these land redistributions were the opportunity for the settling of scores. Encouraged by the party, the poor peasants, who had been used to suffering and humiliation for 2,000 years, raised their heads and gave free rein to their feelings of resentment. Class violence broke out. Over 1 million landowners were executed.
The Chinese peasants had their best 2 years between 1950 and 1952, just after the land distribution and the agricultural reform. In 1950, they were still poor, but life quickly improved from 1952. In my home region, we were farming land which was ours, and we had enough to eat. We gave part of our harvest to the state, and we kept the rest for ourselves. That was plenty. I was young at the time, but I could feel that life was improving. The villagers organized all sorts of artistic activities during the new year, but later all that was stopped.
Mao, the liberator of China and the peasants, was revered as a god of the harvests and worshipped as the emperor of the new Red Dynasty. But from 1953, these land redistributions made Mao fear the reappearance of a class of small landowners. So, on the model of the Soviet Kolkhoz, the party persuaded the peasants to combine their plots into collectives of up to 50 families. This new step was greeted with mistrust, as it meant they had to return the land they had been given 3 years earlier to the community. In spite of everything, Mao still judged the Stalinist model as the ideal, even though the Soviet tyrant died in this same year, 1953. Then, an extraordinary event shook the socialist world. In February 1956, in his famous speech at the 20th Party Congress, Khrushchev denounced the crimes of Stalin, his personality cult, and his disastrous collectivization campaigns. As a result, in China, the Stalinist model praised by Mao was withdrawn. The campaign of agricultural collectivization was suspended, and Mao's ideas were no longer in favor. As always, when he had problems within the party, Mao turned to the people to regain the upper hand. As a good tactician, he invited the whole country to express themselves freely and to criticize the leadership. He called it the 100 Flowers Campaign, and it took an unexpected turn. Delighted at this exercise in democracy, the intellectuals criticized the very nature of the communist regime. For Mao, whose aim was to flush out the critics, the strategy worked. He could then publicly identify all those who had spoken against the regime as class enemies.
You're wrong! What are your political opinions? Do you realize what you're saying? Are you a teacher of the people or not? Do you take the point of view of a teacher of the people?
Mao ordered violent repression. The slightest wrong word could be fatal. Between 500,000 and 1 million people, mostly teachers, were labelled as rightists and deported to forced labour camps where many died of starvation. 3,000 of these dissidents were sent to the Jibiango labor camp on the edge of the Gobi Desert, a so-called re-education camp.
Oh, if only you knew. So many of us died. In all, 70% of the camp's population. At the time, we slept on the bare ground, in holes we were made to dig. The dead were put into big trucks and transported into the desert. They were covered with a thin layer of sand, and over time, their skeletons gradually came back to the surface.
These are the remains of this mass grave just a few years ago.
There is a climate of terror that reaches all the way to the top levels of leadership. Entire heads of provinces are being removed in 57-58 and replaced by hard, unscrupulous men who are often willing to benefit from the very radical winds that blow from Beijing.
The repression of the rightists removed all opposition and opened up the way for the great leap forward. The Communist Party was able to do what it wanted without any resistance, because no one dared speak out anymore.
By silencing his enemies, Mao regained total control of the party. He returned to Moscow in November 1957, but his long-standing ally became his main rival. When Khrushchev declared that the Soviet Union's economic production would exceed that of the USA in 15 years, Mao took up the challenge. He said that China's steel production would exceed that of the United Kingdom in the same period. $100 million were recruited from all over the country to work almost with their bare hands on building projects on an epic scale, constructing roads, railways, dams and canals. For Mao, there was no doubt, the great leap forward to a communist society had really begun. The slogan "Dare to Think, Dare to Act" became the official line of the party. Mao symbolically went out to work sites to lend the peasants his support. To underline the fact that he had rallied the whole party behind him, he was accompanied by Liu Shaoqi, the party's second in command, and Zhu Enlai, his closest comrade in arms. Liu confirmed his support for Mao by saying, "Hard work for a few years, happiness for 1,000." All means were used to mobilize the masses and to stimulate revolutionary zeal. In an extraordinary campaign, Mao identified a new enemy. Sparrows were accused of eating the crops. The Chinese were called out in their millions to prevent the birds landing. As a result, the sparrows died of exhaustion and gave way to a new enemy, insects. They proliferated and ate part of the harvest. This absurd campaign was followed by another step towards radical collectivization. During a journey, Mao saw a banner in a field praising the merits of the first experimental People's Commune set up in Henan province. He declared with enthusiasm, "The People's Commune will be the bridge that will carry China towards the socialist paradise." The saying was taken up in all provinces, and in just one summer, thousands of communes were formed. They consisted of up to 2,000 families. There were even plans for enormous communes, combining up to 10 or 20,000 households, which would be headed by cadres, who were totally dedicated to Mao. The working day started at dawn and finished after dark, accompanied by music to the glory of the great leap forward. As the basic unit of the future society, the commune experimented with a completely new way of life. Here, everything was designed to immerse the individual in a collective life geared towards production. All private property was abolished. Houses, animals, land, and production tools became collective property. Nurseries and free, compulsory schools liberated women from their maternal duties so they could work in the fields.
At that time, I was very young. I was a member of the Youth League and in charge of propaganda, so that shows that I believed in communism. I thought communism was fantastic. From when we were tiny, we were taught that the communist paradise would soon come, and we only had to endure a little suffering and make a few sacrifices to reach it. That was how I saw things.
The family unit disappeared, and children were made to live by the new rules of collective life. The individual was nothing more than a cog in a big machine.
I think the words were, socialism is good, something like that, but I can't really remember. Did you sing different songs when you were at home? We only sang in school. Outside life was very hard. There was never any let up. Why would we want to sing?
As in a barracks, men and women were separated and grouped in dormitories. Sexual relationships were regulated.
Men and women were separated and couldn't live a married life. Some couples went to the fields to continue their sex life, but when they were caught, they were publicly humiliated. Some women found it unbearable and many committed suicide.
So you pulled everything and all lived together?
The household items were pulled in the first year. The furniture was seized for firewood and everything that could be destroyed was destroyed. The pigs, the sheep, everything was collectivized. Even the pots and pans were seized because families weren't allowed to cook. No one cooked at home anymore.
The aim was to force the peasants to take their meals in the commune's collective canteens. In some of them, they even abolished money. A system of work points was established. Food was distributed according to merit, i.e., each person's capacity to fulfill the production objectives. The notion of wages disappeared.
It was compulsory to turn up every day. If your name wasn't on the attendance list, you were punished and you lost work points. They took points away from you. Yes. But without work points, you had nothing to eat. The fewer work points you earned, the less food they gave you. Oh, it was miserable. I can tell you that life was brutal for everyone at that time, except the cadres. Those people lived well.
Kill! Kill!
The party cadres became the officers of the people's communes, which were transformed into real barracks. Every day, the peasants underwent military training because the masses had to be mobilized for the national defense.
Every morning, the peasants gathered at the entrance to the village and waited for the group leader to allocate the tasks. At the end of the day, the leader shouted, "Work's over! and the peasants went to eat. They weren't motivated and productivity was very low. That was one reason why productivity didn't increase.
In the people's communes, peasants had no right to free speech. Their skills weren't taken into consideration anymore. Everything was decided by the authorities, who mostly knew nothing about the subject. They decided everything. The distance between each rice seedling, the type of seed, the amount of fertilizer to be used. Land suitable for one type of crop was used for another. As a result, the peasants became totally demotivated, and poor harvests caused the first food shortages. But Mao always wanted more. To increase agricultural production, he made communes compete against each other. The ones that recorded the biggest harvests were rewarded in ceremonies organized by the party, while the inhabitants of the communes were terribly short of food. This was a world where achieving record production, called launching a satellite, went hand in hand with announcing falsified figures. The cadres were caught up in an escalating spiral.
At the provincial meeting, my superiors asked me what I thought about it all. Some places have launched plenty of satellites and declared high levels of production. What do you think? My back was against the wall and I had to say that I would respect the quotas without fail. But in reality, I couldn't keep those commitments. It was impossible.
They showed Soviet advisers a field of wheat where the ears were so extraordinarily close together that they supposedly supported the weight of six people. The photo was on the front page of the People's Daily. Everyone was fooled, and those who weren't were too scared to say it was a con. Lying became common at all levels of the hierarchy. The figures for agricultural and industrial production were falsified throughout the country to meet and even exceed the targets set by the party.
In the autumn of 1958, although there was some wheat, there was a shortage of food. The town of Dangshan in the region of Shangsu boasted about good harvests, and we went to take a look. It was supposed to be a fertile area. Everyone who went quickly realized that it was all nonsense. They showed us piles of crops where the cereals were on the top, but underneath was just straw or stubble. Everyone understood what they'd done, but no one dared talk about it. I saw the trick too.
As a consequence of these exaggerations, the tax paid in grain by the communes was calculated on a false basis. In some regions, the result was that the state demanded almost all the amounts really harvested. To make matters worse, the spring harvest in 1959 was disastrous.
The wheat had hardly been cut when all the members of the commune were made to carry the crops on their back to a boat which took them away. They did it at night by torchlight.
As soon as the crops were gathered, the wheat was taken away.
Yes.
They were shipping it out to pay debts.
Yes.
Do you know which country had to be paid back?
How would I know?
So who told you that the debts had to be paid?
The cadres said that. At every harvest, Deng Xiaoping said debts had to be repaid even if the country was very poor.
Did they leave you a little bit or not?
A few kilograms. Far too little to feed us till the next year.
The famous debt was the one that China had contracted with the USSR for the purchase of hundreds of factories that were delivered ready for use. Beijing undertook to repay Moscow in the form of agricultural produce. Mao wanted to accelerate repayment, even if it meant people starving in the countryside. In some regions, people really had nothing to eat.
I was sent out of the village on a mission, but the members of my family who stayed behind were reduced to eating the bark of medlar trees.
Tree bark?
Yes, tree bark. They ate the roots of banana trees too, anything they could find. People also ate mud, a sort of white mud. Stems of rice too. We were so hungry that we filled our stomachs with whatever we could find. Once I saw an adult collapse. He fell to the ground while trying to eat a sort of bean paste. He died in front of me. And he still had the food in his mouth. So I laid him under a tree. We were so hungry, soon afterwards we started eating the leaves of that tree.
In other provinces, the shortage of food gave the cadres, who distributed it, the power of life or death over the inhabitants of the commune.
In theory, peasants were entitled to 250 grams per day, but the cadres allocated themselves much more. They were so corrupt that they stuffed themselves shamelessly. Those who didn't get on with the leader of the production team or those who disobeyed his orders were starved to death.
He who does not work shall not eat. That is the principle that was applied from 1958 to 1962, meaning that entire categories of people deemed to be unfit, deemed to be too weak or vulnerable, pregnant women, were deliberately cut off from the canteens and starved to death. That qualifies as murder.
Were the cadres here very violent?
Yes, very cruel. I remember that when they caught some peasants who had stolen some roots from the fields, they tied them up from head to foot. In village number 8, one violent cadre beat several people to death. The collective canteens became a sort of weapon in the hands of the cadres who managed them. I know of many examples, like the case of one man in charge of a collective canteen in a village in the province of Qinghai, who one day summoned a very beautiful woman. She was suffering a lot from the famine, and the cadre asked her how many days it was since she had eaten. And he ordered her to undress. When he saw her naked, he said, "Why are your breasts shriveled?" The woman answered, "My chest is now as flat as a man's." The cadre demanded that she bring him her daughter. Her daughter was very young, but she accepted in exchange for 2 miserable loaves of bread. She killed herself soon afterwards.
In the spring of 1959, Mao's frenzy took another form. The great helmsman demanded 100 million tons of steel in the next 3 years. Since the production of the steel factories was insufficient, the peasants also had to contribute to the effort. They made small blast furnaces out of whatever they had.
To make the small blast furnaces, we used mud mixed with hair to make it stronger. Many female comrades had to cut their hair. My youngest daughter also had to cut her hair, and she cried, poor child. But it was compulsory. Nearly all the trees in China were cut down for fuel. Forests were razed, and people had to melt down pots and kitchen utensils. Even school bells, ironwork on doors, everything was melted down. And all the press rejoiced. The population was used in an absurd way. Anyone did anything. Society as a whole fell into a sort of indescribable madness.
Officially, China started producing millions and millions of tons of steel. In reality, all that came out of these foundries was an unusable metal. These small blast furnaces worked day and night and mobilized tens of millions of peasants for nothing.
Steel is one of these magic indicators of progress within the socialist world. The consequence, of course, is that the farmers are worked literally to death, and the grain is taken literally out of their mouths. But that's a price worth paying, in Mao's view. Here was the top leadership meeting in Shanghai, dining, drinking wine, buying cheap cameras, being entertained. The idea that Mao somehow didn't realize that there was mass famine in the countryside is a myth. It's a complete myth.
A top secret document found in the archives reveals that not only was Mao completely aware of the peasants' distress, but it was part of his strategy to sacrifice the countryside in order to feed the cities and the industrial and political centers. It's a report on the debates in a Politburo session dated 25th of March 1959. Mao stated, "When there is not enough to eat, people starve to death. It is better to let half of the people die so that the other half can eat their fill."
And at that very same conference in Shanghai, he actually orders procurements of grain to be increased to one-third, an unheard-of level. He says it very clearly. He says, if you take up to one-third of the grain, the farmers will not rebel. He makes available thousands of trucks to go and carry out that task.
In July 1959, Mao gathered the leaders of the party in Lushan, far away from Beijing. The original objective of this conference was to correct the increasingly apparent issues with the Great Leap Forward. The famous Marshal Peng Dehai was the only one who dared express himself in an open letter to Mao. The son of a peasant, he was upset by the destruction in people's lives caused by Mao's policy. He begged him, "Please think of the people." This was an insult to Mao. He forced him to resign from his post as Minister of Defense. This episode marked a tragic reality. No one else would dare to defy Mao as he persisted. The years that followed were terrible.
When I went to the villages, oh, it was hard not to cry. In Mangdangshan, to the north of Yongcheng, as soon as we arrived, we saw the houses were empty, totally deserted. People were lying on mats with empty stomachs and their bodies swollen from lack of food. We could see they were dying of starvation, it was obvious. In that county, 120,000 people died out of a total population of 1 million. Around one inhabitant in 10 died of starvation. Countless others were suffering from oedema. Can you imagine what it's like to starve to death? To spend your days with nothing to eat? You got very thin, and as you got thinner, at a certain point you had swelling. You'd be so swollen that it scared people. You had bruises all over your body. And in those cases, you shouldn't eat salt. But many people stole salt to eat in secret.
Were you there when your grandparents died?
Yes. What did they die of? They died of starvation, of constipation after eating mud to ease their hunger. We didn't even have a coffin to bury my grandfather in, so we buried him directly in the earth.
Did no one bury the people who starved to death?
Who could do it? They often died by the road, far from their families who weren't strong enough to bury them.
I was walking along the river when I accidentally stepped on the belly of a dead body. I let go of the cart I was pulling to run away. A bit further on, I came across another body, a child that time. It gave me such a fright.
The most shocking part of all this is that the population wasn't starving to death because of a complete lack of food. The state's granaries were full. In the time of the dynasties, when there were famines, the emperors opened the reserves and distributed the food to the people in distress. Conversely, the leadership of the Communist Party, a regime that claims to serve the people, refused to help the people who were starving and didn't open up the granaries that were full. That really astounded me. Whole populations were camped around the granaries. They begged, "Communist Party, give us a little food." They begged until the starvation finished them off. It was unimaginable.
The regions where the famine raged were cordoned off. It was forbidden for people or information to circulate, but many sought to escape. The few people who could move about saw that the destitution was widespread.
When the train stopped in the station, I saw crowds of starving people stretching their hands through the windows to ask for food. Everyone was suffering from hunger at that time. All those people were fleeing the famine. Children, old people, they all ran around the train to beg food from the passengers.
From 1958 onwards, the cities are quite literally protected from the countryside. People are not allowed to just move about freely. A farmer who brings a cow to market will need to travel with a permit from his local cadre. People who try to flee the countryside are sent back.
Mao's radical methods caught the attention of his Soviet counterpart, Nikita Khrushchev, who was informed by his advisers on the ground. During the grandiose ceremonies for the 10th anniversary of the Chinese Revolution, he took Mao aside and begged him in vain not to repeat the excesses of Stalinist collectivization. Khrushchev would say later, "Mao thought he was an envoy of God charged with the divine task of building socialism before the Soviet Union." Mao ignored Khrushchev's warnings. He gave the order not just to carry on, but to increase production figures, which he said were necessary to the successes of the Great Leap Forward. 9 months later, Khrushchev suspended cooperation agreements with China and repatriated 15,000 advisers. It was the beginning of the split between the two countries. Liu Shaoqi, elected president of the Republic in April 1959, tried to restrain Mao, who was still chairman of the party. But another year would go by before Liu Shaoqi ordered investigations into the reality of the famine on the ground.
I went to investigate in Yongcheng, which is the biggest county in the Shangsu region, because I wanted to know what was really going on. Yongcheng wasn't under my jurisdiction, it was under Shangsu's. When the local leader found out that I was investigating, he told me lies. He ordered all the people I saw to repeat the same about the death toll from starvation. He said that in total 90,000 people had died unnatural deaths. In reality, the total was 120,000 people, as we said at the time. You couldn't say they had died of starvation. He instructed each district to declare a certain number of deaths. so that the total never exceeded 90,000. All that was to hide the truth from us. Three high-ranking officials started investigations. They came to a result of several tens of millions dead from starvation. They wrote a report for Mao and Chu Enlai, but Chu Enlai immediately told them to destroy it and not to talk about it. A few days later, Chu even called them to make sure the report had been burned.
At the University of Hong Kong, Xu Jun is working with Frank Dakota, who has accessed certain testimonies from those investigations. These documents show terrible realities, which confirm the report of these three high-ranking officials.
There's a very detailed report by a high-ranking military who goes back to his home village in Hunan. And he sees that the graves in the fields have been tampered with. They've been opened. There are no bodies inside. So he wonders what is going on. It's a rainy day. He sees the house of the local party secretary, the smoke coming out. He walks up to the house, opens the door. He sees four large pots in which body parts are being boiled down. And it turns out that the local party secretary has decided that you can actually recycle human bodies, simmer them, and then use it as fertilizer on the fields.
During the Great Famine, thousands of cases of cannibalism were recorded in official reports. There are plenty in the archives. I know of one case in Gansu where people ate their own dead relatives. The mother, before she died, said to her daughter, "There's nothing left of my body to eat, just my heart. When I die, you can eat my heart." And that's what happened. When she died, her daughter ate her heart. But she, in turn, was eaten a few days later.
In one case in Hunan province, very well documented by a top working team sent into the countryside, they found out that a man was forced to bury his own child alive, because this child had also stolen some food. The father who was forced to bury that child died of grief 3 weeks later.
In the spring of 1961, President Liu Shaoqi went to investigate for over a month in his home province of Hunan. He found out that friends and members of his family had died of starvation without him knowing about it, because the local cadres had hidden the truth from him. He was upset. For Liu, the great leap forward had to be stopped. But it was only in 1962 that the party brought together 7,000 cadres from all across the country to put an end to the crazy undertaking of the great leap forward. Liu Shaoqi said that the party was largely responsible for the famine. He contradicted Mao on that issue, because from the start, Mao had estimated the harmful aspects of the party's policy to be only 10% of the reason for the famine. Although the famine continued to claim victims until the end of 1962, the situation slowly improved with the re-establishment of farming on privately owned plots of land and free markets. Radical collectivization in the countryside and senseless quotas for farming production, as well as steel production in small blast furnaces, were all stopped. The Great Leap Forward was over.
But I have called the foreign minister here, Mr. Tavish has, and has got permission to photograph freely in Peking. And I think that if this information were communicated to the people whose permission you were asking about.
The world knew nothing about these 4 years of tragedy. The regime at the time put everything in place to hide the truth at all costs.
There were Western journalists working at the New China Agency. They translated our articles into English. In the 1960s, these foreigners regularly took their holidays in the province of Anhui. Everything was arranged for their arrival. The shops around where they were staying were filled up with food. Stylishly dressed girls were conscripted to canoe on the lake close by. The staging was magnificent, and the foreigners wrote articles when they returned, swearing that there was no famine in China.
Everything was staged to make the Western journalists believe that China was a paradise of virtue and plenty. In the same way, foreign political leaders were taken in. Returning from China in 1961, François Mitterrand described Mao as a humanitarian and certainly not a dictator. He said Mao had assured him, "The Chinese people are not on the verge of famine. I repeat, in order to be clearly understood, there is no famine in China." It was an enormous lie. The Chinese leadership knew perfectly well that their policy was killing tens of millions of people. The question of who should answer for these acts before history was an issue of power more than ever before.
Liu Shaoqi was called to see Mao Zedong by a swimming pool. And Liu Shaoqi made a mistake when he said, "You and I are responsible for the famine. And all of it, including cannibalism, will go into the history books. History will judge us." At that point in time, I think Mao already sealed the fate of Liu Shaoqi and thought, "This man is my worst enemy."
Mao didn't want to be placed in difficulty by this subject or by others. So to regain power once more, he led the Chinese youth into the movement of the Cultural Revolution against the party bureaucrats. He took advantage of the radicalization of the situation to have Liu Shaoqi criticized and then arrested by young Red Guards. Imprisoned and without medical care, Liu died in a cell in 1969. From then on, no one would dare speak of the Great Famine again and of Mao's responsibility in this tragedy.
Who is responsible for what happened? There can only be a very simple answer to that, or a very complicated one. The very simple answer is that Mao, Chairman Mao, was responsible. He initiated it, he started it, it was his vision, he stopped it. He was responsible from beginning to end. Mao ranks as one of the great mass murderers of the 20th century. The more complicated version is, how did one man get away with all of this? So it seems to me that it is both a man and a system who are both responsible for this. It's a collective responsibility of the Communist Party of China at that time.
Why, 50 years after the Great Famine, do the authorities still refuse to recognize the reality of it, to discuss it, and to draw lessons from it? I think their attitude is stupid. The authorities are convinced that it would damage the legitimacy of the communist regime and threaten its leadership. In my opinion, their fears are unfounded. Do you know why I wrote my book Tombstone? I'm a member of the Communist Party myself. I wrote this book primarily to lighten the shoulders of the Communist Party, which continues to bear the huge burden of this history. Certainly one day it will have to rid itself of this weight, and the sooner the better. I'm convinced that a nation that can't really face up to its history has no future.
When Mao died in September 1976, he left behind a country in ruins. The nation paid tribute to the great helmsman in a grand funeral. But in the gathered crowd, many must have been thinking about their loved ones who died in the Great Famine. Today, the figure for the death toll still divides historians. Yang Jisheng estimates that the 4 years of the Great Famine killed at least 36 million people. Frank Dakota estimates the death toll to be at least 45 million. Other Chinese historians put forward the figure of 55 million, almost the same as the total number of victims in the Second World War. There is no monument in China to commemorate them, apart from this modest edifice in the middle of the Henan countryside. It was put up a few years ago by a peasant who defied the silence that the communist leadership has always imposed on this unspeakable Holocaust.
Okay, so that was the audio for that documentary. I thought it was pretty interesting. Now, in the podcast last night, I played a couple of YouTube videos. I think it was maybe one YouTube video of this guy. His website is waltersworld.com, W-O-L-T-E-R-S, world.com. So it's not a W-A, as you might imagine. It's W-O-L-T-E-R-S, world.com. And he's got all these travel videos. So he's got a couple of more about China that I thought were pretty interesting, because it's the type of thing that someone coming from North America that's never been to China, it's the type of thing that you would really want to know, you know, because he kind of goes into different things, you know, of sort of pros and cons, and you know, if you go to specific, in the one he's talking about Beijing, and if you go to Beijing, what you should really do as a tourist, you know, the coolest things to do, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to go ahead and play these. So here's the first one.
Hi guys, Mark here with Walter's World, and we're in Beijing, China, at the Temple of Heaven, as you can see behind me. And we've been in China for about 5 weeks now, and there's some things I wish I would have known before we got here, and that's why we have this list of 12 things that you should know before you come to China. Now, the first thing you should know is, don't drink the water, okay? Ice and tap water, not good for you, okay? When you go to restaurants, what they'll do is actually bring you boiled water, still hot, and that's kind of what you drink to start off your meal, okay? But do not drink the tap water or the cold water, okay? Unless it's bottled water or the boiled water they give you at the restaurant at the very beginning, okay? The second thing you should know is you don't tip in China. The only people you tip are probably your tour guides and the drivers for your tour buses and stuff. Otherwise, there's no tipping. I mean, in the taxis and the restaurants, people actually were giving our money back to us. So you don't need to do the tipping. So that's one thing that I like to know beforehand. The third thing to know is when you take taxis, and you will take taxis around Beijing, Shanghai, around China, they are very cheap, but make sure you take metered taxis, official taxis, because if you take what are called the black cabs, the black taxis, you could get in trouble. They could, you know, take you for a ride to places you don't want to go. So make sure you take metered taxis. The fourth thing you should know is when you come to China, sometimes you're not sure, oh, is there a different time zone? Because it's bigger than the US. And in the US, we have four time zones in the continental US. In China, there's only one time zone, the Beijing time zone. So you don't have to worry about that. It's the same time everywhere. So whether you're flying or taking the train or whatever, it's always the same time, okay? The fifth thing you should know before you come is the plugs. Now, I was trying to figure out what plugs to bring. Do I have European plugs, US plugs? Well, Chinese plugs are actually an upside down V, but in pretty much all the hotels, you're gonna have a plug on the top of that V that'll work with US plugs and European plugs. So you are okay with that. You don't need to bring a converter unless you're going into, you know, some villages and you might need one, but most of your hotels will have the plug for US or European hotels. The sixth thing you should know is the air pollution. Guys, here in Beijing and Shanghai, the pollution can be so bad, they literally say women and children, you know, children and old people, do not go outside. It can be very bad, and I do recommend you buy a really good mask. Not just the cheap face mask that you get, but get a really good one. Spend the money. We did, and it makes a big difference, especially if you have like asthma or any kind of breathing problems. It's gonna be a big problem here with the air pollution, so stay informed about that and keep track. And I know in Beijing, the embassy actually has, US embassy actually has a little thing that says, hey, is it safe to go outside to breathe the air or not, okay? The seventh thing you should know is cash is king here in China. There's ATMs in Beijing, Shanghai, all the big cities have ATMs, but people prefer if you pay with cash. And when you go into the villages and the smaller places, sometimes it's hard to find those ATMs. I mean, you can find an ICBC maybe, but just know that you need to carry a lot of cash around. Yuan is the currency here. You're gonna use it all over the place, and try to get small denominations, because when you go to the ATM, they're gonna give you hundreds. But the thing is, if you go get a soda, it's 3 yuan, which is 3 tiny bills. So try to get smaller denominations to make your life a little bit easier. The 8th thing you need to know is there's very little English spoke here. I get kind of upset with all the, you know, the guidebooks and all kinds of stuff. They say, oh, well, have your hotel write down the name of the place you're going to go and then give it to the taxi driver. The thing is, guys, not all the hotels do have people that do speak English, so that can be an issue. So do learn a little Chinese before you come. We do have a few videos from here in China about learning some basic Chinese, but that will be a little difficulty for you. So you really need to know that just because your hotel says there's somebody that speaks English doesn't mean they're going to be there all the time. And English is not spoken everywhere. So the menus and stuff like that, it can be kind of an adventure going out to eat, okay? Number 9 on our list, if you're thinking of going to Hong Kong from the mainland, guys, you need to get a double entry visa, because when you leave mainland China and go into Hong Kong, you actually go through customs and all kinds of stuff, and then you'll be coming back into China. So you need to get a double entry visa or a multiple entry visa if you're going to be coming from the mainland to Hong Kong. It's very simple. When you apply for your visa, hey, you know, just put you want to go multiple times, they give it to you, no problem, okay? The 10th thing you should know, there are a few taboos here in China. You don't talk about Tiananmen Square, you don't talk about Tibet, you don't talk about human rights or internet censorship. China feels that, hey, these are Chinese issues, so we'll deal with it. We don't tell you how to do your business, so don't tell us how to do ours. So do not talk about those things. It'll make your conversations a lot more smooth when you are here. Number 11 on our list is bargaining. Guys, the price that people tell you first, you know, if you want to get your hats and stuff like that when you're here, the first price people tell you, realize that's not the end price. You're going to be doing 50% of, at least 50% of what they actually initially start. That's what you should end up paying. But just know that bargaining is all the time, and it can get annoying, because for everything you do, you're going to be bargaining. Unless you go to a supermarket or a mall, you know, or the restaurants, those prices are pretty fixed. But a lot of times in the markets and stuff like that, for, you know, your hats, you will be bargaining for that. So, and now Caleb's here to help me with number 12. And the 12th thing you should know, and this is the most important one, are the toilets. Now, Caleb, how are the toilets here?
Bad.
Bad. Because they're a hole in the ground. So get used to squatting. Also, toilet paper does not come in the stall. And pee on the floor, that happens too. But the toilet paper is not in the stall, it'll be out on the wall, or it won't be there at all. So make sure you walk around with some kind of like Kleenex packets and stuff like that for your own kind of toilet paper. Also, when you go into the toilets, usually they're a step up or a step down, something like that. So a lot of times you'll see people tripping over them when they go in, so be careful with that. So those are kind of 12 things that I wish I would have known before I came to China, and that really will help you have a better idea of what to expect when you get here. Now, you want to go run? Oh, we got Lian too. Lian wants to be in too. So, I hope that helps you get ready for China. If you want to have more stuff, we got 5 things you'll love to hate about visiting China, the top 10 places in Beijing, all kinds of great stuff here from Beijing, Xi'an, all kinds of places. Check them out at our website at waltersworld.com. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, and we appreciate all your likes and subscriptions, and have a great time in China. It is a fantastic place. The food, the people, the sights. I mean, it is awesome. So, bye from Beijing, China at the Temple of Heaven. Bye.
Okay. So that was the first one, and I've got another one here. I think he's going into the, you know, he starts off with 5 things you're gonna hate about Shanghai, and 5 things that you'll love about it. So here we go.
Hi guys, Mark here with Walter's World. We're in Shanghai, China, one of the coolest cities you should definitely check out when you are in Asia. I love it. When I told my mom I was coming here, she loved it so much, she sent me 7 SMSs in one night to tell me how great it was. And you're going to love it too. But the thing is, any city you go to, there's going to be things you're going to love, like seeing the awesome skyline here, and there's going to be things, and the cool people, and there's going to be things you're going to hate. Now, I'm just going to turn us this way on the boon, because the nice skyline you're used to is just right over there. But since the sun's in the background, I'll point in a different direction. Anyway, any city you go to, there's going to be things you're going to love and hate. And Shanghai has a lot to love and a few things you're not going to like. And that's why we have the 5 things you're going to love and hate about visiting Shanghai. So, what are the things you're not going to like about coming to Shanghai? Now, the first thing is, if you've been traveling in China, you realize that it is a very affordable place to travel around, to stay, to eat, and things like that. Well, Shanghai is the most expensive city on the mainland. So if you're looking at hotels, you're going to be spending more. The deposits at the hotel are going to go up too. Okay, the restaurants, your bang for your buck won't go as far. Now, having said that, it still is a lot cheaper than traveling to Hong Kong or going to, let's say, Singapore, or going to Europe or the US or even Australia. I mean, it is cheaper than that, but it is more expensive than the mainland. So if you're used to, you know, you're having your budget set by your time in Xi'an and stuff, it's not going to work here. So that's the first
first thing you're not going to like. It is more expensive than the rest of China. The second thing you're not going to like is there's not a lot of old China here. Now, if you're coming to Shanghai for the weekend and you're expecting to see the river towns and feel like you're in Kung Fu Panda or something, you're not going to have that in Shanghai because it is a very modern city. I mean, the city has completely changed in the last 20 years, and I'll try to get you some pictures to show what, you know, the skyscraper part looked like just 20 years ago, okay? But having said that, there are some places outside of town you can go to, but if you're going to the old part of town, it looks like it's kind of like almost like a strip mall. There are some nice things to see that are kind of older, like the Yuan Gardens and stuff like that, but in general, you're not coming here for that old world, old China feel. You come here for the modern feel, and that kind of sucks. It's like, you know, you want to see the old world China kind of stuff, but it's not here, okay? The third thing you're not going to like about Shanghai is, guys, this is our sixth week in China, and I've never felt like I had to, you know, hold my wallet or check my bags and stuff like that. Here in Shanghai, I definitely feel less safe. I mean, I still feel safer than anywhere in the U.S., but I feel less safe than anywhere else in China. And so, and you do have more pickpockets, you do have more beggars, you do have more people coming up to you saying, hey, taxi, taxi, you know, at the train station when you come in, the high-speed train, which is by one of the airports, you got people grabbing you, say, hey, we have a taxi, come on, come on. You're like, no, I want to get the taxi line. I mean, you do feel a little bit less safe here than you do in other parts of China, so do be careful because there are more pickpockets. There are more, you know, little robberies here. I mean, there's still no, like, bad crime. But still, just be careful of it because that's one thing you're not going to like. It is a little bit less safe than the rest of China, and you will notice that and you will have that feel. The fourth thing you're not going to like about coming to Shanghai is a lot of the things, you know, it happens to be in my 5-11 Hates of China video, you know. People are spitting on the streets, you know, when you go into the elevator or the metro, people are coming in when you're going out, you're getting smushed all the time, things like that. And it can be a bit much, so get ready for being claustrophobic, bumped around, all kinds of things like that. So you might think, well, they're kind of rude. And the people aren't quite, I don't think they're as nice as you have like in Beijing or Xi'an, definitely not in Xi'an. But so just be prepared for some of these things like the spitting and the crowds and all kinds of stuff like that. And the fifth thing you're not going to like is, guys, this is a tropical climate and it gets very, very hot, especially in the summer. You're going to have 40 degrees or, you know, 105 degrees during the day. Yesterday, I literally looked like I was in the swimming pool. My wife, who never sweats, she sweated twice in all of our trips. Today was the second time, and I even said, oh my God, you're sweating. So be prepared for the heat. So if you're going to do your sightseeing, do things in the morning. Guys, it's 6:30 in the morning and I'm already sweating. I know I'm a big guy, but it's hot already at 6:30 in the morning, okay? So be prepared for the heat. So bring your water around, okay? Take that with you. Don't be afraid to pay the extra money to get water when you're going through the shopping malls and stuff like that. Just be prepared for it, okay? So just know that's the heat is one of the things you're really not gonna like. But those are the five things you're not gonna like about Shanghai, and those are things you can deal with. I mean, it is a really cool city and you really should come. So what are the things you're gonna love about Shanghai? So now we have the five things you're gonna love about coming to Shanghai, and I'll be honest, guys, this is a great city. You will have a really nice time here. You're gonna have a lot of fun. There's all kinds of cool stuff to do. It's just more of a modern things to do. Now let's get started. And the first thing you're gonna love is seeing the city at night, especially when you see this here all lit up, you know, the Citibank building and the Oriental Pearl Tower and the World Financial Center. I mean, it is so cool to see it at night with all the lights and everything. You really feel like, wow, it's a neon paradise. And if you can take a boat tour while you do that, it is extremely cool. Take an evening boat tour, you're going up and down the river, seeing all the lights and stuff like that. It's probably the coolest thing to do here in Shanghai, and you really have to do it, okay? So that's the first thing, enjoying the lights of the city at night and taking a boat cruise, okay? That is so cool. The second thing you're gonna love about coming to Shanghai is going to the French concession area. Now, Europeans kind of dominated Shanghai for quite a period of time, and they left an impression here. So architecture, food, stuff like that. And the French concession area is where you see that the most. So the architecture, the shops, the boutiques, the restaurants, you do feel like, oh, you're going in some back lanes in Paris or Berlin or something like that. And it is kind of cool because it gives a really kind of international feel to it. But it is really a nice place to go. And honestly, that's one of the favorite things my mom loved. And I know I'm not telling you to go because my mom went there, but she was right. It is a really cool place. Great place to go shopping. If you're tired of Chinese food because you've been traveling a long time, you don't have good Western food, you go to that area there. It's really cool. So that's the second thing you're going to love. Going to the French concessionary and just enjoying all the stuff there. The architecture, the food, the shopping, all kinds of stuff. The third thing you're going to love about Shanghai is it is an international city. You know, there's the architecture. I mean, you can see all kinds of cool international architecture here. There's all kinds of expats here. There's all kinds of travelers here. A lot of Westerners. There's a big influence of stuff. And that's one of the things I love about port cities like this is you have all this mix. And it has a very international vibe. So that means the restaurants, hey, you know what? They speak English a lot more, and so do the hotels. You won't be gawked at like you are in other parts of China. We go to Beijing, Xi'an, Xi'an, Tianjin, all kinds of other places. My kids, literally, we spend an hour taking pictures with people. Here, no one asks to take our kids' picture because they see all kinds of Westerners all the time. So you do blend in better. So I think you have a better chance of feeling more like a local here than anywhere else in China. But this international feel of the city is really cool. And yes, there's the French Concession, like I said before, but there's all kinds of other stuff on here. The Boon behind me has all kinds of great architecture to enjoy and all kinds of nice stuff. The fourth thing you're going to love about coming to Shanghai is the food. Now, Chinese food overall, I mean, it's different everywhere you go, and the food here is different too, but I think it's even better. I mean, this has been the best Chinese food, except for the lamb soup in Xi'an. This has been the best food in general I've had anywhere in China, but when you come here, you want to have the dim sum, the dumplings, because that's what's kind of especially up here, and there's one you have to have. You'll see a picture of it. It's a big dumpling, and they have a straw sticking in it. Well, the thing is, there's kind of soup inside, so you stick the straw in. Don't go too far, because if you pop the bottom, your pants are going to get full of soup, like my son unfortunately found out. Okay, so you have the straw in there. You suck out the soup inside, and then you eat the dumpling. It is so good. That is one thing you have to have when you're here. And the food is fantastic in Shanghai. You will enjoy it. Yes, it's more pricey than other places, but you know what? It's worth it because it's so much better, okay? So that's the fourth thing you're going to love, is the food. And the fifth thing you're going to love about Shanghai is, you know, I said, you know, you're not going to like it. You can't get all this old China feel. Well, you can outside of the city. There's some amazing day trips. That's number five. The amazing day trips from here, okay? You can go to Suzhou and see all the gardens there and the canals. You know, you can take a gondola there. It's a lot cheaper. It's not as cool as going in Venice, but it's a lot cheaper to take the gondola there, see those things there, walk around. You go to Hangzhou and you can see the people dancing on water there. And you can do one of my favorite ones, is going to Xitang, which is kind of like this old river town. Like, you imagine Kung Fu Panda in real, like the town in Kung Fu Panda in real life. That's kind of like what it is. Your hotels can arrange a lot of these day trips for you. It's well worth going to, but there are really great day trips, because if you're tired of seeing skyscrapers and, you know, seeing all these things, you want to see, you know, real old-fashioned China, you want to do the day trips from here. Suzhou, Hangzhou, and my favorite, Xitang, are fantastic. So those are the five things you're going to love and hate about visiting Shanghai. It's a great city. I really recommend you coming here. So does my mom, obviously, because I think she's texting me now saying, how's Shanghai? But if you want to learn more about visiting Shanghai, top 10 sites to see here, five things you love and hate about visiting China, other things, a few basic Chinese language videos, check us out at our website at waltersworld.com. Bye from Shanghai.
Very, very interesting. Looks like a neat place to visit. So, you know, if you're going to go on your world trip, you know, take your mask with you and visit a place like Shanghai. It looks, it looks pretty cool. You know, in the video, it looks pretty cool. So, anyway, I think I'm going to go ahead and cut this off, get headed to bed. Hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.